I won't get in the way. Seeing a tape like a video like this, and there's so much that was said, where do you begin? Obviously, he's very well prepared. He spent weeks, perhaps months, preparing this, and now we look at it for an hour and we're ready to ask our deep questions. But one thing popped to mind I wanted to ask the Rabbi Gross is, why did Hashem make us this way? Why do we have to go through all this? Why are we tempted to do things that are in our nature that we don't want to be doing, and now we go to all this effort to get back to where we think we ought to be? So maybe we can start with that.
This is not planned. but that kind of takes us a little bit off of this thing. I have a bunch of material on that question, which maybe we'll get together another time to discuss. But the very quick answer is as follows. At least my answer that I would give is as follows: that there's a great question that drives theologians crazy, which is, can God create a rock that he cannot move? Right? Can God create an immovable rock? And that the reason why that's such a difficult question is, on one hand, if you want to say, well, yes, God can create anything. God is God. He can do what God wants. So he can create an immovable rock. So if that's the case, so then the question we come back to is, well, then does that mean God can't move it? Because if God can't move it, that means that God is imperfect. And we kind of start with the premise that God is perfect. So, on one hand, we have this, can God create a rock that he cannot move? So, the question that we take that to make that a little bit more practical, might be, is God perfect? And we say, yes, we understand God is perfect. And then the question is, okay, if God is perfect, can God improve? So we want to say, well, God is perfect. God can't improve. So wait a second. Does that mean that God is lacking the trait of improvement? Does that mean God is lacking the capability to possibly get better? So, oh gosh. So we don't want to say that. So the answer is, and this is something that we don't have to necessarily understand. Our thoughts are not exactly God's thoughts. I think there's a verse like that someplace. We don't necessarily understand it, but that's the paradox of human existence. That on one hand, God is all-knowing and all-perfect and all-being. On the other hand, there is space for an imperfect man. How could God create an imperfect man? So for that very reason, because God has the ability to improve. So the way that God can demonstrate God's improvement is through human beings. So how can a human being demonstrate improvement? The only way that man can improve is if there is some kind of counterforce keeping man's improvement back. And that's really the purpose of life, to overcome that improvement. That God, in a way, has created a gap. God created the Kabbalistic term for this is what we call tzimtzum, that God contracted himself and left open a space. That space, on one hand, is empty of God, on the other hand, is filled with God. That's another paradox, etc. And the need to fill that space is humanity. The ability to fill that space is through you and me and all that people do. That's what we call tikkun olam. We've heard the term tikkun olam. Tikkun olam means fixing the world. What does it mean, fixing the world? Creating that perfect world, fixing the world that God created somewhat broken. So that's where we fit in. That's why we're created with challenge, as a demonstration of God's ability to improve.
Okay. And Stephanie, from your experience as a clinical social worker working with families, so we talked about getting rituals, getting habits to bring in good practice, to make best practice our everyday practice. How do we keep these things fresh? Whatever we start, after a while it can become a habit. You do it mindlessly and then it loses the benefit. How do we keep pulling ourselves back? Keeping it fresh is beneficial.
Well, I think that, you know, something that Tal Ben-Tar said was that doing it first. And so concentrating on the ritual, implementing it for 30 days, let's say, if you are having trouble connecting with your family and you want to do a family dinner, you know, start off doing that twice a week, and then you could move it to three times a week, and you could, you know, teach your child how to cook and do things like that. So mix it up.
So you're saying start small, work up, because they mentioned to start with a few things and then grow from there. But he didn't talk about what size, what bite size. I mean, you could take on a few large things and not be able to handle them and fail. So how do you manage to figure out the size of your challenge or the habit you're going to accept the difficulty of the habit?
Well, and I think it's different for every person. It just depends on what they're trying to achieve. Like if you want to do family dinners and your family doesn't do family dinners together, then maybe doing it 7 nights a week is a lot. And so starting off with doing it once or twice. And so just kind of feeling it out so that way you can be successful and not feel like you're not achieving your goal. You can just build from there.
So they call it science, but there's really a lot of art involved, I guess, right? Okay, sure. Let's open to some questions from the floor. But like Rabbi Gross said, they should be pointed questions that address the message of the video, and we'll try to deal with it. Yes, Mark?
I'll stand up so you can hear me. So when I've learned a little bit about change, you talk about behaviors and attitudes, but really underlying all that is some core beliefs and values, which are sort of the bedrock of who we are and ultimately how our is manifested in our behaviors. From a Torah perspective, I guess what's the important element there about kind of, and is it the core values that we have are important? You know, core value like, you know, people are good or people are not, are basically not good. Or is it really just the behavior, the outward element of ourselves?
You want to talk about it first?
I'm a little confused by the question, Mark.
Okay.
Oh, thanks.
Would you like to amplify it or narrow it down?
He spoke a little bit on the video about the idea that that most change, that change that needs to take place, or growth that needs to take place, usually stems out of core beliefs. So where do those core beliefs come from? So in our environment, the environment in our shul here, so we could kind of have the premise that we have core beliefs. Let me know if I'm going on the right track, though, Mark. All right. So we kind of have the premise that we have the core beliefs, that we have an idea that there's such a thing as God and such a thing as Torah and mitzvos, and that in theory those are good things to do. Now, how integral is that to my being? So that's something that sometimes we need to work on, that we need to improve on. But the core belief, we look at various righteous people in our religion and say, wow, like that person's got it. Right? So that, if we can say that about those people, and we kind of can put those people in our head, then that means that we have an idea of core beliefs. And our question might be, well, how do I get to that point? What do I need to do in order to get there? So then we're kind of stuck with, okay, well, how do I get there? And that's where I think this video comes in of, well, let's pick it apart. There's 613 mitzvahs, so let's do a change here, a change there, and eventually they'll become habitual, and that will lead to where it leads. So, I'm in the God business a little bit, and I kind of come in with a premise that we have that we have those core beliefs. Stephanie doesn't always have that. I mean, to turn somebody around to develop core beliefs is, I think, a greater challenge. That's kind of why the job that I'm in. Stephanie wants to tell us how you can develop core beliefs when there aren't there. I mean, how do you actually teach core beliefs?
Well, I think that, you know, when the person wants to work on something, for them to decide what, if they don't have any beliefs, you know, what they would like to believe in, and then to go from there and to start small. You know, he talked about physical health. So if that's something that's important to you, then, you know, even if you don't work out, you've never worked out before, then just start off doing it a little bit, and then it will become a belief. It will become part of your life, which is a value.
And how long does that take?
He said 30 days.
might it take longer?
It might take longer.
I have a question. What's the Jewish view on hypnosis?
It's been done. I was hypnotized at Yeshiva University. It was part of a psychology class. The class took 10 minutes. It was great. We went under and then we were out. It was wonderful. I got a good nap in. It's something that could be effective. I think it's something that's used, something that is effective. I mean, that really goes into the realm of you know, someone asked me, I would ask, well, what does your psychologist think? And what does your psychologist hope, or therapist, or social worker, etc., what do they hope to gain by doing so? It's like any other medical treatment, I would think. Yes?
Question. I think I got lost. I didn't get the segue between the idea of the core belief and the anatomy of happiness. Can you maybe give me that segue? And change, the issue of change in that regard.
Right. So I'm going to jump off a little bit and lean over to the psychology side of the table. Since psychology is not a very old field, it's only 100, 150 years old is the whole field of psychology. Secular psychology. Freud, that whole chevra, that whole group. So it's not a very old thing. So the question was, what formed it? What was their basis for the whole field? There's obviously no God, right? That's kind of the premise. So if that's the case, I should be able to be happy by doing whatever I want. On the other hand, it doesn't work, right? People just do everything, whatever they want, so there's no happiness there. That's what they ultimately find, is that there's no happiness there. So the question was confounding these, the Gedolei psychology, so to speak, is, well, how do I, why not? And if there's really no God, then what is the point of doing good? I mean, why do I need to do good if there's no God? So that's where you start getting all of these theories about ego versus superego, according to Freud, or the idea of congruence, according to Carl Rogers, that we're trying to focus on finding where we're supposed to be, and we should be congruent with what our reality is. All those different titles that was given over the years, I think are really all code words for our neshama. I mean, we're our soul. What is our soul? What does our soul really want? And so us within this room, so we believe in the concept of neshama, that we believe in the concept of having a soul. And we believe to fulfill that neshama, to fulfill the needs of that neshama, we should be attempting to do good. So how do we know what good is? So also, thank God, God gave us a Torah. He gave us a Torah filled with morals and mitzvahs, etc. And that should be able to satisfy our neshama. So where does our core beliefs come from? Our core beliefs are that we have a, perhaps could be translated into the word neshama. And how does change is getting better according to the 613 mitzvos. And the ability, and we assume that ultimately reaches happiness, that a person is doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Happiness comes from a person fulfilling their purpose. What is their purpose? Their purpose is fulfilling the needs of their soul, fulfilling their inner needs. Does that fit? Any follow-up?
And prayer in this thing comes...
Prayer is a way of perhaps coming in contact. Is coming in touch with our needs, coming in touch with our connection with God, which is our connection with our soul. Our soul is really our connection with God, so it's getting in touch with what our inner needs are, or what Freud would call superego, what Rogers would call congruence, etc. And prayer is also serves the need of thinking about where I can move from here, what's possible. This is really another talk about prayer. In a way, really means dreaming about the future and kind of hope and trying to think about what's ultimately possible.
So, if what you're saying is so, it would seem out of line for a person who wasn't not thinking in Hebrew, for example, to pray in Hebrew. And yet, this is what we do. We have people that are unknowledgeable of the language, they pray nonetheless in this language.
I would agree. I mean, there is
the kavanah is not going to come, and therefore the whole thing breaks down. I would think.
Prayer without kavana is a big problem, correct. We do encourage people, certainly, to pray parts that they don't know in English or a language that they understand.
Would you say that we're all learning in some degree? So if someone doesn't know Hebrew at all, so davening in English is good, and then you take certain key parts and learn the Hebrew and the English and master that, and then grow from that. So part of it is a more meaningful ritual, and part of it is a learning experience. Would you say that? And then as time goes on, more and more of it becomes meaningful, understandable, and then with work, you have the focus on what's being said. I think a lot of times people daven routinely or rotely. While they're davening the Hebrew words, whether they understand them or not, their mind is planning their day, and that becomes a less rewarding ritual, whereas the ideal is to focus on what we're saying. I mean, people say the Pledge of Allegiance. How many people really think of what the words mean? It's the same thing. You have to be focused, I would think. Do we have right. another question from the floor? Brian?
Yeah. The theme of the video that I saw was that we're imperfect and we change or produce happiness. Yet Tirthi Ambose teaches us that who's happy, the man is content with what he has. Can we reconcile those two things, that should we be happy with what we have, or should we be striving for more to produce happiness?
The answer to that is on focusing on the positive class.
All right.
You have to work a little bit.
Okay. I'm afraid to give my answer. I would answer very, very, very quickly. I think that Mishnah is usually, we use that Mishnah, that who is happy, that is who's happy with what they have, as in terms of gashmius, in terms of physicality, as opposed to in ruchnius, in things of spirituality, we're hoping to grow. Although I would add in the end of this video, I'm going to stick to this video, the end of this video I think was drilling that point, that yes, we are happy with where we are, but we certainly see that there's room to grow. Right, that we should be happy with where we are. That's what Rosh Hashanah, in a way, the conflict. There's a conflict about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that just passed. In that, is Rosh Hashanah a happy day, or is Rosh Hashanah not a happy day? Right. So on one hand, we do have a concept of simcha, that we are in a way happy on Rosh Hashanah. On the other hand, it says explicitly in the Code of Jewish Law that we don't use the word sason. The word sason, joy, is not used on Rosh Hashanah. So why not? So we've alluded to this a little bit before in synagogue. Simcha is the joy of growth, the joy of that we're moving, that we're doing things, that we could be happy with where we are, we should be happy with the process that we're on. But the idea of joy, that we've completed the process, so that we don't have on Rosh Hashanah. We might have it on other, on Sukkot and on Pesach, etc., when there's things that we can look at that we've accomplished. But Rosh Hashanah is the festival of growth, in a way, the happiness that we're along in the process. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
Barbara.
What was the end of the question? If we can,
the impact that we can not limit that to ourselves, but limit that to those who are closest to us, so we can encourage the growth within ourselves and create a situation where encouraging growth within, for the others closest to us without the judgment to kill us.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really good point and a very healthy idea. And also, just with feelings, instead of, a lot of people will say, I'm angry, you can feel angry instead of be angry or irritable, as you said. And it really, that way you're not that emotion, but that's just the way that you're feeling at that time, because we are constantly changing. So I think that's a good point.
I have a question. They were saying that self-discipline is a limited resource. Mm-hmm. Is there a way of building that muscle, so to speak, to make it less limited?
Well, for me,
me, that actually alleviated some pressure, because I always thought that it was my failing if I wasn't as like strong or self-disciplined as I know myself to be. So to realize that it's that some people will consider it that it's a limited resource permits me to not put so much pressure on myself, to allow myself to exert that kind of self-discipline for a certain amount of time and to apply it, and then once I've exhausted it, to then realize that I need to ask for help. So for me, that was the first time that I heard that concept framed that way, and I thought, like, how interesting that the Jewish values are so different from American values, in a way. And I guess what I mean by that is that to seem as if a person has needs, you're considered needy. And if you're considered needy, you're considered weak. And you're considered inept or incapable, or, you know, because we're built on resilience and we're built on strength. So when he articulated that idea of self-discipline being considered a limited resource, I found that to be such a relief. Not to give myself permission to actually, like, you know, throw everything away, but to
be
just,
human.
Right. It's like giving yourself permission to identify resources and to say, like, I need help. And in the Jewish community, it's found.
Do you want to comment there?
And I think that it is something to be aware of, you know, like for a fast day, for example, you're not going to be able to do as much. And if you're dieting, you know, maybe arrange your day so that it's not so challenging. Otherwise, you know, you might eat chocolate chip cookies or whatever because you're, you might have a harder time saying no. So,
what about the idea of removing the temptation? If you're watching TV and you always eat peanuts when you watch TV, why exercise self-discipline? Put away the peanuts.
Right. Well,
I mean, is that a way of just directing your self-discipline where you need it?
I mean, there's just a lot of temptations in our society, you know. I mean, constantly there's all these delicious food commercials, food we can't eat, and, you know, so figuring it out also as well as putting it away, but...
I'm going to take this question. Barry, I see you. one of the readings for this, the movie comes with readings attached to it. I won't give them. I'm not sure I'm supposed to discuss the readings, but this one I have in the book form, so it's okay. The Michtav Meliyahu, Rav Dessler, which is one of the readings for this class, talks about something called the Nekudas HaBechira. I'm not sure we've spoken about this in Shul yet, which means there is the point of choice. What does it mean, the point of choice? That, which is a sliding scale, that every person is someplace on the realm from, I don't know, we'll say, Haman HaRasha, nobody in this room is as bad as Haman. And I'm not sure anybody in this room is as good as Moshe, Rabbeinu. But we're probably someplace in the middle. And to say that everybody has the same challenges is simply not true. That's what his point is. His point is that we don't all have the same challenges. We all have different challenges based on where we are from this range from Haman to Moshe. So somebody who... most people probably don't have an urge to murder. I hope not too many people in this room really have that much of an urge to murder. I hope not many people in this room have an urge to steal. Now, it could be some more people, or we're closer to having an urge to steal than we're having an urge to murder. That's because our, what we call Nekudas HaBechira, the point of choice, is moved to that point where certain things are things we have to work to get away from, and certain things are things that we don't have to worry about. The Talmud makes a comment that Ashrei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how great is God, that He wants to give us reward. So how does God make sure that we get reward? Because He made it a mitzvah in the Torah not to eat bugs. So how many people in this room really have an urge to eat bugs? So not too many. So what the Gemara is telling us is, wow, God made a couple of mitzvahs that were gimmies. God gave a couple of mitzvahs that we're for sure able to do as a way to slide us up the scale a little bit. And then wherever we are on that scale, so then we have a couple of things that we have to worry about and a couple of things that are just, we don't have to worry about doing wrong. And perhaps there are a couple of things that we can't even think about doing good. Meaning, maybe we don't have the possibility now to sit down and study for 10 hours straight. Other people do have that possibility of choosing to do that. We might not have the possibility of choosing that right now. But perhaps we can keep on working our way up the scale to get to that point where that becomes in the realm of our possibilities.
By the way, I think one article in the Wall Street Journal about the
I hope you weren't tempted. Barry, did you have a question? Take care. Yeah.
What is the mechanism by which we can slide up to the Chiru?
Point up.
Right, so that's the, what was the word he used there? It was a really neat word. Neuroplasticity? I thought that was so neat. I think that's what, that as we take these slow, if you say I want to do so much too fast, so then it's not something we can grasp, and we've kind of reached our self-control limit. Moreover, I found that extremely enlightening also. We've reached our self-control limit, we end up losing, and that ends up being bad news for us, right? We in a way, we're called miyaish, we give up, right? We forget about the possibility of growth. So I think what we talked about, change, moving ourselves up, is to fix small things, little by little, to grow up. Take this upon myself, that upon myself. I'm going to go to a minyan twice a week, or I'm going to go to a minyan one more time a week than I did, or I'm going to going to pick 2 hours a day that I specifically make sure I absolutely will not say an evil word about somebody else. Right? And then there's choice about when those 2 hours are going to be. I could start maybe at 6 to 8 in the morning, right? And then maybe move to 8 to 10 o'clock at night. I absolutely will not say a bad word about anybody else. And as we grow in that way, it becomes a habit, right? Then that nekuda, that mark of choice, ultimately will move further and further up the... The behavior versus attitude portion there, I think, was the hint to that, but the specific examples are things we kind of have to work on by ourselves. Maybe one more.
Neil, did you have a question?
Yeah. I actually looked at this film as a mechanism for moving along the ladder. My question is, moving up the chain, as you put it, my question is, or my problem is, where am I on the chain? How do I assess where I am, and what do I need to do to make myself?
Right. Right, yeah, we talked about that that question when we met beforehand of how do you choose where to attack first? I think it's different depending on how old you are and where you are in life. From being, as the rabbis don't have as much power as they used to, and rabbis don't really legislate, we can't really legislate for communities anymore, nor do we legislate for people. So what rabbis are kind of stuck doing is maybe pointing out things that this will be in your interest to grow. And I think when you start analyzing, well, I got so many things I want to work on, and we all have so many things we want to work on, and even the things that we do well already, we want to work on and perhaps do better. I kind of have to figure out where that is. I'm tempted to say, you do what you want. I'm tempted to say that you pick out a few goals, and if you pick out a few, you pick out two, three, four, whatever it is, then that will lead to the other things. Other things will take care of itself. If you're having trouble with those two, three things, if you're having trouble with those two, three, you know, coming up with two, three, four things, we can make suggestions. Sometimes, if depending on how well a relationship you have with other people, such as your spouse, your rabbi, your parent, your whatever, they can make those suggestions for you. But I think if you're on your own in a vacuum, I think there's nothing wrong with saying, I know I have to work in these things. Very quick story on that. I once heard of my teacher of Tversky, I may have mentioned this in Shul before also. Mayor Tversky brings the following example, that Maimonides writes that when something bad happens to you, you have an obligation to look into yourself and see how I can improve. What have I done wrong and how could I do better? So Tversky points out, so let's say you get a sore throat, you get strep. Right? So that would lead me to believe that, well, maybe there's something wrong with my speech. So I'm going to make sure that I don't speak Lashon Hara for 3 hours a day. That might be what I think it's coming to teach me. Now really, God didn't give you strep for that reason. God gave you strep because you talk in synagogue too much. Right? So meanwhile, here I am working on my Lashon Hara, and my evil speech, and God is like twiddling his thumbs, waiting when I'm going to finally figure out that I really should stop talking in shul already. All right, so is that really what's going on? Tversky said, if you're working on the wrong thing, are you really ever working on the wrong thing? You're never working on the wrong thing. You're improving. You're always improving. And I think if you pick out a few things that we're going to improve on, that will lead to other things. Maybe I'll pass over to Stephanie to take this question as well. Because I was wondering when you run through, as we talked about also, when you have these situations where there's maybe perhaps several substance abuses going on at once, or there's a cluster of issues within a family and things like that, how do you pick one thing to work on and move from there?
You know, I think if there's a lot of things kind of running around in your brain, to be able to just do something basic like make a list of, even if there's 10 things you want to work on, okay, so you're not going to work on 10 things this month, but maybe for the whole year you go work on 10 things. And then prioritize, you can number it, and so that way you have a visual. And see through that and see maybe 2 things and start with that, or even just 1 thing, and do 1 thing 1 month, and then the next month another and another.
Maybe let me add on one more thought to this. I think then we'll conclude. We'll be here. We're here all week. When I was in Riverdale, I interned for Jonathan Rosenblatt, and one time I was in the car with him, and a girl called from Israel, one of the girls in the shul, called from the synagogue, and who was studying in Israel for the year. And anybody in this room has ever gone to study full time in a yeshiva, so there's this point in the year that I've noticed this growth. I went there as a student, and I went there as a dorm counselor also. So as students go through this year of growth, so they usually come from a place where learning's not very important. And they start learning, and then they get into it a little bit. So they pick up, they realize, oh, I need to learn that. I need to learn law. And then another person, then they think, you know, I don't really know anything in the Bible. I got to start learning the Bible. And they say, well, I got to work on myself a little bit, so let me learn a little bit of some of the Musar works. And before you know it, they're up to 1 in the morning because they realize there's so much that they have to conquer. And then at that point, at 1 in the morning, they usually get the flu, because it's usually around like December or January, and they get the flu, and they're sick for 3 days. And then it's, okay, well, where do I go from here? Because for me, worrying so much about all the different things that I've lacked, I need, you know, I got myself sick. So some kids give up at that point, right? Well, that's it, right? That's the problem. That's giving up. I took on too much at once. They give up. So one girl called Ray Rosenblatt. I happened to be in the car at the time. And she was in this frantic stage of, how am I going to learn everything? And to which he responded, said, this is what I do when I think of something that I don't know that I need to know. I put it on the list. I put it on the list. And that way, if, you know, when I think about things that I don't know, I say, oh, don't worry, it's on the list. I'll get to it. It's something that I know I'm going to get to. And in fact, that's a good thing, you know, to think about Yom Kippur when we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please give me another year. Please give me a year of health and happiness, etc. So perhaps it's a good idea to say, God, look at all these things that I'm planning on doing this year. Right? If you don't give me a good year, it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work. So I think when you have a bunch of things, so how do you choose what they are? So we can sit down and make a list, 10, 15, 20 things that I want to do. How to choose which one to do first? My experience just talking to, you know, Balabatim, talking to people who, you know, people in this room is, pick one you want. I think pick one you want, and as we have a little bit of success, so I think we will continue growing from there.
Can I
so,
have the best word?
You are. Some
my prerogative. I don't need to play.
Oh, we know that.
So we all have a big list of things we want to do. What do you do first? Well, you did it. You're here. That was your first step. We heard that we walk out of here and we take action. That's your second step. So you decide what the action is and do it. And we'll be great. Refreshments outside. Thank you, Tom.